Welcome to The Telegram. I'm Tim Stanley. As of Saturday, gay couples will be allowed to get married. So what? Who cares? We ask why this dramatic social change has happened with so little protest, and what it means for society and for religion. Also, why watching The Killers is more fun than watching The Detectives. I'm joined in the studio by The Telegraph's Graham Archer, by Father Andrew Kane, by Peter Williams of Catholic Voices, and by the crime writer Alex Marwood. This Saturday, gay marriage comes to Britain. We were warned by one UKIP councillor that it might cause more flooding. But apart from some late spring drizzle, this remarkable social revolution has passed with very little excitement at all, which contrasts strongly with France, where thousands of conservatives poured into the streets of Paris to protest what they saw as the wreckage of the most important civil institution that we've got, marriage between one woman and one man to the exclusion of all others. Britain, it seems, just doesn't give a hoot about who weds who. So what does the legalisation of gay marriage say about our society, and what will its consequences be for the future, particularly for people who are religious? I'd like to start by asking Graham Archer, one of our columnists who is in a civil partnership, what it tells him about the country he lives in.
Well, of course, it makes me happy, but I think, to your point, Tim, about the lack of visible outrage, that speaks to the ancient good common sense of Britain. A very few of our compatriots became very excited before the reform was enacted, but most of us knew, and now everyone has seen, that the sky is still there above us. The only impact I can see from this change is that for gay people and their families and loved ones, the amount of love and joy on the planet has been increased, and that's to the detriment of nobody.
Peter Williams, you're a Catholic. You've observed this as someone who's commented a great deal upon the change. Were you surprised, disappointed, or even pleased by how civil the whole thing's been?
I wasn't surprised. I was somewhat disappointed, but because I wasn't surprised, I wasn't that disappointed.
Right.
I saw this coming very much. And the reason why I think this wasn't a big deal so much in British society is not necessarily because people wanted this change. In fact, there were no marches in favour of it. The vast majority of people who seemed to make any kind of public demonstration about this were almost universally against it. I mean, we had 60,000 people signed the petition that said, yes, we want this, and then 600,000 odd said, we don't want it. What should that tell you? But the reason why most people couldn't care less about this is because the vast majority of British people don't really care about social issues compared to the things that directly affect their lives, the bread and butter issues like health, education, taxes. Those are things that really upset people or exercise them and make them vote a particular way. The vast majority of people don't care about these sort of totemic issues. And that's why this was
There's nothing totemic about my life. And I would rather we could have the discussion at a level that avoids this idea people as individuals don't matter because there aren't very many of
us. That, of course, begs many questions, including the idea this was about the good of same-sex attracted people. I don't grant that at all because I don't think this really benefited anyone. There's no real practical benefit this gave to same-sex attracted people or anyone else, really, because we already had civil partnerships.
Can you see inside my heart?
What has your heart got to do with this?
Said that this didn't bring any advantage to anyone. I'm asking you if you can see within my heart to know the answer to your question.
I don't think it's relevant. If you're saying that you needed the public blessing of your union, I would ask, well, why do you feel you needed that? Because I don't really think that benefited you in any real positive
Forgive
way.
Forgive me, that would be a question as
this
to
is, this
what...
This is Father Andrew Kane, by the way.
Yes. Why any couple needs a blessing of their relationship, whether gay or straight?
Oh, I agree. I'm actually in favour of abolishing marriage entirely as a legal institution, because I don't really think that the state should be involved in this issue at all.
Thought that, or did you adopt that position after the proposal for marriage reform?
Well, funnily enough...
A la UKIP.
Funnily enough, the Catholic Church has actually been against the civil institution of marriage since the 19th century. The encyclical by Pope Leo XIII actually was against the whole idea of having a civil institution of marriage. So in that case, I'm sort of adopted sort of knee-jerk libertarian position on that. However, I think if there was going to be any purpose for the civil institution of marriage, it would be because it was trying to prescribe the relational ideal for the formation of the family. That clearly very much is the relationship between a man and a woman, so that there can be that complementarity of male and female in the the bringing up of children. That's the purpose of marriage, if there ever was one. Now that we've reduced marriage to...
Since you've already argued that this affects so few people, it really wasn't worth the legislative time, in what sense is your archetype of marriage threatened by the extension of the institution to include same-sex couples?
Well, it is and it isn't.
Which heterosexual couple won't get married because myself and my partner will?
I've never argued that. What I would argue...
You just said the archetype was threatened by the institution.
I didn't mention the term archetype. You were the one who mentioned it.
Well, no, but Peter, what I would argue, you did say, Peter, that you don't think the state should be involved in marriage anyway. Mm-hmm. Why does it trouble you, or why would it trouble you, that the state chooses to redefine something that you think is a
change will affect what I called the archetype. I don't remember the exact word you used, apologies. Okay. But you did say it would threaten the model of complementarity inherent in the...
What I actually said was, if there is any purpose to there being a civil institution, a legal institution of marriage, that is to prescribe the relational ideal. Now, if we then say, we're going to redefine what that is, we're going to redefine the legal institution. And it is a redefinition. You know, when you redefine, when you change the direct object of a verb, you change the nature of the verb itself. And in this case, to marry has now been changed. That will have a social effect. It's basically divorced the legal institution from the natural institution of marriage, and therefore made the social institution rather problematic.
Okay.
That's why I'm against this.
Absolutely,
Father
clear.
Andrew, please.
Marriage is not simply about the procreation and raising of children.
I didn't say it was only about that.
Marriage.
I want to let Father Andrew.
You're quite right.
A marriage is actually about two people making a consensual decision to live together and make a commitment to each other. Mm. And personally, I think the gender of those people makes no difference whatsoever to their choice to make that commitment.
Fair enough.
Your argument would then require us not to allow people who choose not to have children to marry, or people who are too old to have children not to marry.
Well, actually,
I think that makes no sense.
Actually, it wouldn't, because even people who are heterosexual couple who choose not to have children could still change their mind later. And even if they didn't change their mind, if they wanted to, let's say they couldn't, as with the old elderly couple, let's say they tried to adopt, they could still provide that basic complementarity of male and female to whatever children they had. But in any case, the fundamental heterosexual nature of marriage as an historic institution is there precisely because we had this early pair bonding 12,000 years ago, or thousands of years ago in our history. We had human pair bonding, which was, of course, by definition, between a man and a woman. That led to a family, that led to kinship, that led to the tribe, which led to the nation. In other words, marriage is a fundamental social institution that is It's fundamentally about the nature of the family. Now, it doesn't mean it's all about that. There is a romantic element to it, but I would say that it is fundamentally also about
imagination to assume that the only argument in favour of blessing same-sex union as marriage is for the romantic requirements of the two parties involved, because it implies that those two individuals aren't part of families other than themselves, and that their bonding together doesn't bring those two families together. Apologies for sounding slightly upset. I detest the argument that because I'm gay, I have no other interest in everything else in society, and that rewarding my lifelong commitment to my partner is just a way of patting my fragile little ego on the back. It is entirely about the bonding between our two families and all the older generations and the ones coming after us. It's not just to satisfy our needs for the next 12 months or however
many. I completely agree.
A couple of years ago, maybe 4 or 5 years ago, I blessed a lesbian relationship. It just had their civil partnership. And the relationship, they lived on a council estate in Sheffield. Quite rough. Mm. And at that celebration were their neighbours, their families, their friends, their work colleagues, the whole community that surrounded those two young women as they made a lifelong and permanent commitment to each other. It was absolutely about family and community and commitment and longevity. And to reduce marriage simply to procreation and the raising of children is to do a disservice to marriage and to everybody who is married. And actually, as Graham says, it isn't, I would say, an insult to the gay community in this country, which has made it very clear for many years that our relationships are of equal value to those of any straight couple and deserving of protection and honouring.
Mm-hmm. So if you want that, we already had that with civil partnerships.
Did you support the introduction of civil partnerships?
I would say actually that
you... Did you support the introduction of civil partnerships?
Actually, no, but for different reasons.
If
Can I complete the point? I think actually what we should have, what we should have had to very begin with, is allowed all the relational benefits that accrue to marriage and indeed civil partnerships to be available to anyone for whatever reason under any kind of organisation of their family. I'm actually in favour of simply...
What are you trying to defend?
Well, what I'm trying to defend...
find the fact that lesbian and gay people want to celebrate their relationships within the communities of which they are a part and build families and stable home units which will benefit not just themselves but everybody around them, provide care for the children that they adopt, for the children that they give birth to, the families that they nurture, the old people they care for. What are you trying to protect?
I'm not against any of that. I think they should be absolutely able to do all of those things. What I'm saying is that legal marriage has only one purpose, if there was going to be an institution of legal marriage at all, and that is to prescribe the relational ideal. In other words, the ideal form of relationship for the formation of the family. And two men or two women cannot bring that complementarity of male and female to a child.
This now, I'm not reducing... Can I finish?
I didn't interrupt you.
No. Now, if I think you've had rather a lot of...
I also want to move the debate on. Father Andrew, you're in a very personal position because I believe you intend to marry your
partner. I'm getting married in June to my partner of 15 years.
And that is going to have consequences for your position as a priest, is it not?
We shall wait and see. I had a meeting with my bishop about a fortnight ago, at which he tried to persuade me that I should have a civil partnership, and I declined the invitation and made it clear that I will get married. And he said we are in uncharted territory for the Church of England.
Right. That's an interesting way of describing it, because we were told by the government that there were locks in place.
Yes.
That means that this would sort of be an issue that would affect civil society, but not the Church itself. But that's clearly not true, is it? It's the Church is going to have to deal with members of the clergy, members of its parishioners, who wish to have gay marriages.
So, and who are getting married. And I personally dislike the term gay marriage. I would indeed safe-sex marriage. This is just about marriage.
Okay.
In terms of the Church of England's position, the government, and I think as a way of just sort of sidelining the Church in this, has provided what's called a quadruple lock, which means the Church of England is not required in law, and indeed cannot in law, solemnise marriages between gay and lesbian people within our own buildings. So I'm a state registrar, and in my churches I can marry straight couples that come to me, but I'm legally excluded from being able to do that for gay and lesbian people. The debate within the church is the bishops are now saying that if a faithful, practicing Anglican couple decide to get married and then go to their priest and ask for some kind of official recognition of that. The bishops published a letter on Valentine's Day stating that they should be basically told off for departing from the church's traditional teaching, and that they should then be given informal prayers at most.
Right.
And for the clergy, the bishops urged their clergy not to get married and said it was a matter of obedience to our bishops.
Right.
Now, and that is of dubious legality.
For the future. That must sound ridiculous after... I can't begin to imagine the stress of the situation that you're in and your bravery for facing up to it. But if we have any hope of moving beyond this reductive shouting dogma at one another and finding a way to return to respecting each other, then we need an institution to work out how we're going to live with each other when we don't agree about something as fundamental about what it is to be married. The best institution, I'm a sad old Tory. The institution that I repose the most hope that it finds a way of us living messily with each other rather than shouting one another down is the Church of England.
The Tory party then.
Well, we're obviously leading the way.
Right.
A Conservative Prime Minister introduced this
reform.
Crucially,
what you're describing, Father Andrew, is a debate within the Church.
Indeed.
Now, do you think it would be at all appropriate for people to bring cases against the Church in order to... Now, Graham, I think this is an important point. This is not an issue of being anti or pro-gay marriage or whatever. This is a question of the proper relationship between state and church. Mm. And do you feel that this is a debate that must happen within churches, or do you see a case for social action or legal action outside of churches to try to change their mind?
And the Church of England, and indeed the bishop, recognised it in their own statement around marriage, has a long tradition of conscientious dissent. Mm. And that has shown itself both in the Church of England's response to divorce over many, many years, where some clergy would remarry divorcees in church and others would choose not to do so. It's been particularly clear in the Church of England the last 20 years in our divisions over the role of women within the ministry of the church, so that we now have women priests and soon to be, thank God, women bishops. And yet within the church, we welcome and provide an honoured place for those who theologically are unable to accept that development. I would argue the Church of England, absolutely, as Graham says, is ideally placed to provide a community in which we can disagree well mm-hmm. about this issue as well. And people like me, and there are many people like me within the church, who have a more liberal and progressive understanding of what marriage is, who will welcome gay and lesbian people, who support marriage in this form, and who would be willing to provide liturgies of blessing.
Right. Peter, how do you feel the relationship between state and church now stands as a result of this legislation?
Well, in a sense, I feel like this isn't my discussion because I'm not an Anglican. However, I do think that there need to be appropriate protections given for people who do dissent from what is the sort of redefined understanding of marriage, that it's just about between the love between people or mutual commitment. And I see that in a number of places, not just in the church, in the Anglican Communion, but also in places like teaching or even in sort of professions beyond that. So, for example, I have a friend who, in a Catholic school, was asked in her class by a pupil, what do you think about gay marriage? And she thought, well, it's a Catholic school, I can say, well, I think that this is wrong. I think that redefining marriage is wrong. And there was a girl who was apparently questioning her sexuality in the class who went and reported her to the deputy head, and she was brought in and complained about that because she was told it's against the law to say that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Now, and there was another friend of mine who just yesterday, funny enough, contacted me. He actually works at Moss Bros, who are bringing out this campaign for same-sex weddings, and he feels that he can't morally engage in material cooperation with what they're doing because that goes against his conscience. All of these different things come up. We need to have protections for people, or at least allow just basic religious liberty for people to say, you know what, I don't agree with this. I might respect and love people who are same-sex attracted. I don't have anything against them. I believe, as the Catholic Church teaches, that all people should be treated with respect and sensitivity and tolerance. However, this goes fundamentally contrary to my conscience as to what marriage is, and those people should be respected as well. And I think that includes people like the Hazel Mary Bull and her husband, and people like that, who had a fundamental conscientious objection, not out of bigotry or prejudice, but out of fundamental, reasonable, and religious conviction.
Can we at least agree on the principle of freedom of conscience?
Yes.
We can, to a point. So my ardent hope is that we don't see a sequence of futile legalistic challenges against people like the Bulls. I've written often about how backward that was, you know, for the best of reasons. The couples who brought the suit against the innkeepers like the Bulls. I understand why they did it, but it really doesn't help. But there's the more of that legalistic activism is done, the less space we will have to listen properly to one another. And it's only through listening, I don't know how we'll get there, but we will find this messy way to live with each other, to try and see the good. But there's a difference between that, in my mind at any rate, and somebody such as, I hate to pick on an individual, but Lillian Liddell, who was the registrar in Islington, who wouldn't conduct civil partnerships. I don't know if I can describe it as an algorithm, but I can see a difference between not wanting to have a guest in your house because of your religious conscience, and choosing to do a job but saying, I don't want to do it for those people.
Right.
And I know that you could prove me wrong deductively there, but there feels to me a big difference. And the legal activism doesn't help. It conflates the two.
She might have become a registrar before, of course, that came in, of course.
Father Andrew.
Yes.
She did.
Do you think that once this has happened, once Saturday has passed, we might emerge a different kind of society which is concerned about different sorts of things? That putting aside issues of sex and sexuality might mean that, for example, we have a conservative party which is more focused on liberty, less focused on matters of culture and lifestyle.
personally, I think that once we've got through the weekend, the fact that people choose to get married, whoever they are, will become utterly unremarkable, and people will continue to celebrate the relationships of their friends and family as they have always done. It just means that some of those people celebrating will be in same-sex relationships. Personally, I hope the church stops worrying about what goes on in the bedroom. And actually, this isn't even about what goes on in the bedroom, actually. It's just simply about the institution of marriage. Mm. And concentrates on the things that are truly important in the gospel, which is about the care of the poor, the orphan, and the stranger. And one of the things I like about Pope Francis is that he has done his very best in the last year to move the church away from an obsessive conversation about other people's sexual activities onto wanting a church of the poor for the poor. And I just hope the bishops of the Church of England can take that example and follow it in the Church of England as well.
Peter, finally, is one of the reasons why Francis is so popular precisely because he is sort of in touch with that popular mood that wants to think less about sex and more about poverty?
I think he's popular because of his manner. To be perfectly honest, I think that people viewed often Catholic popes as if they were this judgmental group of people who only ever talked about sex. Of course, the reality is that it's secular society that talks about sex less than the church. But fundamentally, the Catholic Church is not going to change in its fundamental teaching on this. Pope Francis is simply going to reframe the way that we go about discussing it. And I think that's very valuable. I think talking to people with respect and sensitivity, we were doing that before, but this is making it more pronounced now. But even then, keeping the teachings of Christ and the gospel on sexuality at the same time as talking about all the other things that are in fact fundamental parts of Christianity is exactly what we need, and that's exactly what Pope Francis is doing. So that's
Can
a very
I add
good
one
thing.
Caveat to that. Mm-hmm. Our Lord was entirely silent on sexuality.
No, Saint he wasn't.
Paul.
Matthew 19. Matthew 19, Matthew Mark 5, I came not to abolish the law.
If we carry on, we're going to be very loud literate. About sexuality
and
for a very,
can't
very long time.
Face silence.
Father Andrew Cain, Graham Archer and Peter Williams, thank you all very much. ITV's real-life crime drama The Widower tells the story of Malcolm Webster, a fat and unappealing male nurse who financed his lavish lifestyle by killing his wives. Or at least he tried to. Malcolm only succeeded in killing his first wife and was caught out a second time and is now sitting penniless in jail. It's an odd story for it to be a popular TV hit. There's little tension because the audience knows what's going to happen, and the plot is pretty squalid and depressing. Not just because Webster is a killer, but because so many women actually found him attractive. Yet real-life crime, like fictional crime, continues to sell big. For some strange reason, we can't get enough of knowing what nasty things people do to each other. I'm joined by Alex Marwood, author of the crime novel The Wicked Girls, to explain what she thinks people find so attractive about this genre. Alex, why do people want to read about people like Peter Sutcliffe or Fred West?
Well, of course, actually, if you think about it, reading about the baddies and their retribution is sort of as old as the Bible, really, isn't
right.
it? I think that it's quite interesting that the way that crime itself, crime drama, really became a big thing in the 19th century, fairly much post-Darwin. The Victorians pretty much invented murder as an entertainment genre rather than as the Shakespearean moral dilemma genre.
Right.
And I think that to a degree, I think it is possible that as the influence of God has waned, that people are still looking for sort of some other form of retribution.
But you said there seems to be a tension there between saying it's entertainment and saying it's retribution. I mean,
absolutely. But you know, to an extent, all the stories in the Bible are entertainment as much as their moral fables.
Right, yeah. Right. But I mean, you said it was post Darwin. You said the Victorians did it, and it was about moving away from the moral play. Does that mean that we have some peculiar interest in the mechanics of the crime itself? We actually find the crime itself thrilling?
Well, yes, clearly yes. I mean, if you just look at the degree to which, you know, horror movies are one of the biggest genres that
yeah.
Biggest money genres, it's absolutely clear that, yeah, people are looking for something that is going to make the hairs on the back of their neck stand on end.
Mm-hmm.
I think with true life crime, one of the things that people actually like is the fact that it's yes, it really happened, but it happened to somebody else,
right?
And they can, to an extent, I think that this shows particularly with The Widower. Actually, I'll get onto that in a second. It allows them to feel that they are actually less likely to become victims of these crimes than if they're just nebulously knowing that there are murderers out there. I think that people are as interested in the victims as they are in the actual murderer.
So what it's sort of perversely comforting to know.
Yes,
these
in a funny sort
happen.
Of way. I mean, I think a lot of people who are watching The Widower are probably sitting there going, well, I'd never be so stupid as to be taken in by him.
And why were the women taken in? That's the
Well, psychopaths and charm, it's an absolute absolute classic. Thing. Psychopaths and narcissists both have great quantities of charm and can adapt themselves to whatever it is their audience wants them to be. They can't keep it up, but it's a very classic sign of both psychopathy and narcissistic personality disorder.
So psychopaths make great lovers.
Well, they make great lovers in the first instance.
In the first couple of weeks.
Yeah.
But I found something slightly disturbing about The Widower, that I found myself focusing on his character and not that of the victims.
Well, I think most of it is that is because the show is focused on his character and not that of the victims. I mean, to an extent.
But it means you see it from his perspective. And I'm not saying I felt sympathy, but they did go on at him a lot about money. And I did start...
I don't really blame them for going on about him.
I mean, he spent a lot of money.
He was a raving fantasist who was destroying, potentially destroying their entire way of life. Both sets of marriages were greatly under threat of bankruptcy as a result of his fantasy life.
But is there a risk if you put the killer at the centre of the narrative that the reader or the viewer starts to see things from their point of view?
Well, I think people are interested in trying to get some picture of why it is that that some people do become this twisted and this lost. I think actually that Rhys Shearsmith is playing the part absolutely brilliantly, because the sort of functional disconnect between himself and his actual actions is it comes across brilliantly. The sort of blank effect that that he produces when he's actually carrying out his murders, and I think the conversations he has with the poor drugged wives when they're unable
asleep,
is played absolutely beautifully.
Yes,
I think actually in a lot of ways it's one of the best portrayals of psychopathy that I've seen.
Do you think when it comes to crime fiction, a motive is more important to the readers or the viewers than working out who done it or the mechanics of the plot itself? Is it really... Because we tend to think of, when it comes to something like Agatha Christie, that what's important is figuring out who done it. And it's a puzzle that you can work out. But actually, is really the psychology of the characters more important? Is that what really leaves an impression
on them?
It depends.
You know, there's such a huge variety of different things within the crime genre. It's one of the reasons that I love it so. But I mean, I think in terms of real life crime, of course, it would be very interesting to see how people responded to a show that was based on a murderer who didn't get caught.
Right.
There isn't really. There, I can't think off the top of my head of a true life thing. That involves a part, obviously, from Jack the Ripper. But of course, Jack the Ripper is sort of long enough ago that everybody can feel comfortable and safe with him.
Yeah, and in fact, have romanticised him to some degree.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, they keep trying to sort of turn him into a Hannibal Lecter sort of individual, whereas actually the likelihood is that he was just a totally screwed up person with some form of brain damage.
And that's an interesting point that always fascinates me about crime and murder stories is the desire for some authors to present a murderer who is sophisticated, charming, intelligent, like Dr. Lecter. I mean, I would very happily be killed by Hannibal Lecter. I mean, because you're going to.
I'm not sure.
Well,
if you really
it's going to be painful, but you're going to go out and starve. It's going to feed you well beforehand, and you know that you're going to die with some beautiful opera playing in the background. But most killers are not like that in real life. They're actually knuckle dragging lunatics.
Absolutely. I mean, in my own books, I think the thing, one of the my main driving my main drives is actually to try to get across the banality of evil.
Right.
The fact that the people often actually do this stuff without any planning, without any real conscious intention.
Right.
It is, for instance, terribly easy to actually kill somebody by strangulation, because if you hit the vagus nerve, uh-huh, they can die within about a second,
right,
of you doing it.
Right.
So, in fact, a lot of strangulation murderers are rather surprised people, and they're blokes who wanted to give their woman a scare, and find that within 1 second of them getting their hands around their necks that she's dead.
Right. You see, I find it eerie just hearing you describe exactly that. Can you give us some sense of what it's like to kill someone in a novel? As a writer.
Well, of course, the trouble is, as a writer, you're actually taking hours and hours and hours and hours and hours to reproduce something that happens in a minute. So it's very, very, very different from actually killing somebody. I keep, at the moment, my latest book, The Killer Next Door, has quite a lot of detailed examination of how to mummify a corpse.
Right.
And I keep getting tweets and Facebook things about how I've put people off their dinner and people asking me if I lost weight while I was writing it, but actually, of course, not, because it took me 12 hours to write each chapter, evisceration chapter. And of course, I was eating a lot of biscuits while I was doing it, because that's what we do.
And do you put yourself in the mind of the killer, the person trying to catch the killer, or the victim? Who?
It depends on, you know, which I always have multiple points of view in my books. So that's, you know, but what I do find is that my dream life becomes very, very disturbed while I'm doing this sort of stuff. Yeah. Fortunately, I've always rather enjoyed my nightmares. I think that's probably one of the driving forces behind why I do what I do for a living. But yeah, I get very, very dark and quite violent dreams while I'm in the writing process.
Final question. Oh. Is there anything you've written which readers have felt has gone too far?
Oh, God, yeah, killing the dogs.
Killing dogs, right.
Killing dogs, yes.
Okay.
Yeah. There were, 8 murders in The Wicked Girls, but the only thing that people really, really objected to was the killing the dogs.
Alex Marwood, thank you very much.
Thank you.
For more opinion and commentary, you can find us at telegraph.co.uk.